rocked the market with the announcement that it was taking a big, surprising loss on its portfolio of subprime mortgage loans. It had entered the U.S. subprime lending business in 2003 when it had bought America's biggest consumer lending operation, Household Finance, the same Household Finance that had pushed Steve Eisman over the narrow border between Wall Street skeptic and Wall Street cynic. From the social point of view, the slow and possibly fraudulent unraveling of a multi-trillion dollar U.S. bond market was a catastrophe. From the hedge fund trading point of view, it was the opportunity of a lifetime. Steve Eisman had started out running a $60 million equity fund, but was now short around $600 million worth of various subprime-related securities, and he wanted to short more. "Sometimes his ideas cannot be manifested in a trade," said Vinny. "This time they could." Eisman was enchained, however, by Front Point Partners and, by extension, Morgan Stanley. As Front Point's head trader, Danny Moses found himself caught in the middle between Eisman and Front Point's risk management people, who didn't seem to completely understand what they were doing. They'd call me and say, "Can you get Steve to take some of this off?" I'd go to Steve, and Steve would say, "Just tell them to fuck off." And I'd say, "Fuck off." But risk management hounded them and cramped Eisman's style. "If risk had said to us, 'We're very comfortable with this, and you can do 10 times this amount,'" said Danny, "Steve would have done 10 times the amount." Greg Lipman was now blasting Vinny and Danny with all sorts of negative information about the housing market, and for the first time, Vinny and Danny began to hide the information from Eisman. "We were worried he'd come out of his office and shout, 'Do a trillion,'" said Danny. In the spring of 2007, the subprime mortgage bond market, incredibly, had strengthened a bit. The impact on the broader economy and the financial markets of the problems in the subprime markets seems likely to be contained, U.S. Federal Reserve Chairman Ben Bernanke was quoted as saying in the newspapers on March 7th. "Credit quality always gets better in March and April," said Eisman, "and the reason it always gets better in March and April is that people get their tax refunds. You would think people in the securitization world would know this, and they sort of did, but they let the credit spreads tighten. We just thought that was moronic. What are you, fucking stupid?" Amazingly, the stock market continued to soar, and the television over the Front Point trading desks emitted a ceaselessly bullish signal. "We turned off CNBC," said Danny Moses. "It became very frustrating that they weren't in touch with reality anymore. If something negative happened, they'd spin it positive. If something positive happened, they'd blow it out of proportion. It alters your mind. You can't be clouded with shit like that." Upon their return from Las Vegas, they set out to pester the rating agencies and the Wall Street people who gamed their models for more information. "We were trying to figure out what, if anything, would make the ratings agencies downgrade," said Danny. In the process, they picked up more disturbing tidbits. They'd often wondered, for instance, why the rating agencies weren't more critical of bonds underpinned by floating-rate subprime mortgages. Subprime borrowers tended to be one broken refrigerator away from default. Few, if any, should be running the risk of their interest payments spiking up. As most of these loans were structured, however, the homeowner would pay a fixed teaser rate of, say, 8% for the first 2 years, and then, at the start of the third year, the interest rate would skyrocket to, say, 12%, and thereafter it would float at permanently high levels. It was easy to understand why originators like Option One and New Century preferred to make these sorts of loans. After 2 years, the borrowers either defaulted or, if their home price had risen, refinanced. To them, the default was a matter of indifference, as they kept none of the risk of the loan. The refinance was merely a chance to charge the borrower new fees. Bouncing between the rating agencies and people he knew in the subprime bond packaging business, Eisman learned that the rating agencies simply assumed that the borrower would be just as likely to make his payments when the interest rate on the loan was 12% as when it was 8%, which meant more cash flow for the bond holders. Bonds backed by floating-rate mortgages received higher ratings than bonds backed by fixed-rate ones, which was why the percentage of subprime mortgages with floating rates had risen in the past 5 years from 40 to 80. A lot of these loans were now going bad, but subprime bonds weren't moving because Moody's and S&P, disturbingly, still hadn't changed their official opinions of them. As an equity investor, Front Point Partners was covered by Wall Street stockbrokers. Eisman asked stock market salesmen at Goldman Sachs and Morgan Stanley and the others to bring over the bond people for a visit. "We always ask the same question," says Eisman. "Where are the ratings agencies in all this?" And I'd always get the same reaction. It was a physical reaction because they didn't want to say it. It was a smirk. Digging deeper, he called S&P and asked what happened to default rates if real estate prices fell. The man at S&P couldn't say. Their model for home prices had no ability to accept a negative number. "They were just assuming home prices would keep going up," says Eisman. Eventually, he'd hop onto the subway with Vinny and ride down to Wall Street to meet with a woman at S&P named Ernestine Warner. Warner worked as an analyst in the surveillance department. The surveillance department was meant to monitor subprime bonds and downgrade them if the loans that underpinned them went bad. The loans were going bad, but the bonds weren't being downgraded, and so once again Eisman wondered if S&P knew something he did not. "When we shorted the bonds, all we had was the pool-level data," he said. "The pool-level data gave you the general characteristics, the average FICO scores, the average loan-to-value ratios, the average number of no-doc loans, and so forth, but no view of the individual loans. The pool-level data told you, for example, that 25% of the home loans in some pool were insured, but not which loans, the ones likely to go bad or the ones less likely to. It was impossible to determine how badly the Wall Street firms had gamed the system." "We, of course, thought that the ratings agencies had more data than we had," said Eisman. "They didn't." Ernestine Warner was working with the same rough information available to traders like Eisman. This was insane. The arbiter of the value of the bonds lacked access to relevant information about the bonds. "When we asked her why," said Benny, "she said, 'The issuers won't give it to us.' That's when I lost it. 'You need to demand to get it.' She looked at us like, 'We can't do that.' We were like, 'Who's in charge here? You're the grown-up. You're the cop. Tell them to fucking give it to you.'" Eisman concluded that S&P was worried that if they demanded the data from Wall Street, Wall Street would just go to Moody's for their ratings. As an investor, Eisman was allowed to listen in on the quarterly conference calls held by Moody's, but not invited to pose questions. The people at Moody's were sympathetic to his need for more genuine interaction, however, and the CEO, Ray McDaniel, even invited Eisman and his team to his office for a visit, a gesture that forever endeared him to Eisman. "When are shorts welcome anywhere?" asked Eisman. "When you're short, the whole world is against you. The only time a company met me with complete knowledge that we were short was Moody's." After their trip to Las Vegas, Eisman and his team were so certain the world had been turned upside down that they just assumed Raymond McDaniel must know it too. "But we're sitting there," recalls Vinny, "and he says to us, like he actually means it, 'I truly believe that our ratings will prove accurate.' And Steve shoots up in his chair and asks, 'What did you just say?' as if the guy had just uttered the most preposterous statement in the history of finance. He repeated it, and Eisman just laughed at him. "With all due respect, sir," said Vinny deferentially as they left, "you're delusional." This wasn't Fitch or even S&P. This was Moody's, the aristocrats of the rating business, 20% owned by Warren Buffett, and its CEO was being told he was either a fool or a crook by Vincent Daniel from Queens. By early June, the subprime mortgage bond market had resumed what would become an uninterrupted decline, and the Front Point positions began to move, first by thousands and then by millions of dollars a day. "I know I'm making money," Eisman would often ask, "so who is losing money?" They already were short the stocks of mortgage originators and the home builders. Now they added to their short positions in the stocks of the rating agencies. "They were making 10 times more rating CDOs than they were rating GM bonds," said Eisman, "and it was all going to end." Inevitably, their attention turned to the beating heart of capitalism, the big Wall Street investment banks. "Our original thesis was that the securitization machine was Wall Street's big profit center, and it was going to die," said Eisman, and when that happened, their revenues would dry up. One of the reasons Wall Street had cooked up this new industry called structured finance was that its old-fashioned business was every day less profitable. The profits in stockbroking, along with those in the more conventional sorts of bond broking, had been squashed by Internet competition. The minute the market stopped buying subprime mortgage bonds and CDOs backed by subprime mortgage bonds, the investment banks were in trouble. Right up until the middle of 2007, Eisman had not suspected that the firms were so foolish as to invest in their own creations. He could see that their leverage had increased dramatically in just the past few years. He could, of course, see that they were holding more and more risky assets with borrowed money. What he could not see was the nature of their assets. AAA-rated corporate bonds or AAA-rated subprime CDOs? You couldn't know for sure, he said. There was no disclosure. You didn't know what they had on their balance sheet. You naturally assumed that they got rid of this shit as soon as they created it. A combination of new facts and actual human contact with the people who ran the big firms and the rating agencies had stirred his suspicion. The first new fact had been HSBC's announcement in February 2007 that it was losing a lot of money on its subprime loans, and a second announcement in March that it was dumping its subprime portfolio. HSBC were supposed to be the good guys, said Vinny. They were supposed to have cleaned up household. We thought, holy crap, there are so many people worse than that. The second new fact was in Merrill Lynch's second quarter results. In July 2007, Merrill Lynch announced yet another sensationally profitable quarter, but admitted it had suffered a decline in revenues from mortgage trading due to losses in subprime bonds. What sounded to most investors like a trivial piece of information was to Eisman the big news. Merrill Lynch owned a meaningful amount of subprime mortgage securities. Merrill's CFO, Jeff Edwards, told Bloomberg News that the market need not worry about this, as, quote, active risk management, unquote, had allowed Merrill Lynch to reduce its exposure to the lower-rated subprime bonds. I don't want to get too deep into exactly how we positioned ourselves at any one point in time, Edwards said, but went deep enough to say that the market was paying too much attention to whatever Merrill happened to be doing with subprime mortgage bonds. Or, as Edwards elliptically put it, there's a disproportionate focus on a particular asset class in a particular country. Eisman didn't think so, and 2 weeks later persuaded a UBS analyst named Glenn Shore to escort him to a small meeting between Edwards and Merrill Lynch's biggest shareholders. The Merrill CFO began by explaining that this little subprime mortgage problem Merrill seemed to have was firmly under the control of Merrill Lynch's models. "We're not that far into the meeting," said someone who was there. "Jeff is still giving his prepared remarks, and Steve just bursts out, 'Well, your models are wrong.'" This very awkward silence comes over the room. Do you laugh? Do you try to think up some question so everyone can move on? Steve was sitting at the end of the table, and he starts to put his papers in order really conspicuously, as if to say, "If it wasn't rude, I'd walk out now." Eisman, for his part, considered the event a polite exchange of views, after which he lost interest. There was nothing more to say. I just figured, you know what? This guy doesn't get it. On the surface, these big Wall Street firms appeared robust. Below the surface, Eisman was beginning to think, their problems might not be confined to a potential loss of revenue. If they really didn't believe the subprime mortgage market was a problem for them, the subprime mortgage market might be the end of them. He and his team now set about searching for hidden subprime risk. Who was hiding what? "We called it the Great Treasure Hunt," he said. They didn't know for sure if these firms were in some way on the other side of the bets he'd been making against subprime bonds, but the more he looked, the more sure he became that they didn't know either. He'd go to meetings with Wall Street CEOs and ask them the most basic questions about their balance sheets. They didn't know, he said. They didn't know their own balance sheets. Once he got himself invited to a meeting with the CEO of Bank of America, Ken Lewis. "I was sitting there listening to him. I had an epiphany. I said to myself, 'Oh, my God, he's dumb.' A light bulb went off. The guy running one of the biggest banks in the world is dumb." They shorted Bank of America, along with UBS, Citigroup, Lehman Brothers, and a few others. They weren't allowed to short Morgan Stanley because they were owned by Morgan Stanley, but if they could have, they would have. Not long after they established their shorts against the big Wall Street banks, they had a visit from a prominent analyst who covered the firms, Brad Heintz at Sanford C. Bernstein & Company. Heintz asked Eisman what he was up to. "We just shorted Merrill Lynch," said Eisman. "Why?" asked Heintz. "We have a simple thesis," said Eisman. "There is going to be a calamity, and whenever there is a calamity, Merrill is there." When it came time to bankrupt Orange County with bad advice, Merrill was there. When the Internet went bust, Merrill was there. Way back in the 1980s, when the first bond trader was let off his leash and lost hundreds of millions of dollars, Merrill was there to take the hit. That was Eisman's logic, the logic of Wall Street's pecking order. Goldman Sachs was the big kid who ran the games in this neighborhood. Merrill Lynch was the little fat kid assigned the least pleasant roles, just happy to be a part of things. The game, as Eisman saw it, was crack the whip. He assumed Merrill Lynch had taken its assigned place at the end of the chain. On July 17, 2007, 2 days before Ben Bernanke, the Fed chairman, told the U.S. Senate that he saw no more than $100 billion in losses in the subprime mortgage market, FrontPoint did something unusual. It hosted its own conference call. They'd had calls with their tiny population of investors, but this time they just opened it up. Steve Eisman had become a poorly kept secret. "Steve was one of about two investors who completely understood what was going on," said one prominent Wall Street analyst. 500 people called in to hear what Eisman had to say, and another 500 logged in afterward to listen to the recording. He explained the strange alchemy of the mezzanine CDO and said that he expected losses of up to $300 billion from this sliver of the market alone. To evaluate the situation, he told his audience, "Just throw your model in the garbage can. The models are all backward-looking. The models don't have any idea of what this world has become. For the first time in their lives, people in the asset-backed securitization world are actually having to think." He explained that the rating agencies were morally bankrupt and living in fear of becoming actually bankrupt. "The ratings agencies are scared to death," he said. "They're scared to death about doing nothing, because they'll look like fools if they do nothing." He expected that fully half of all U.S. home mortgage loans, many trillions of dollars worth, would suffer losses. "We are in the midst of one of the greatest social experiments this country has ever seen," said Eisman. "It's just not going to be a fun experiment. You think this is ugly, you haven't seen anything yet." When he was done, the next speaker, an Englishman who ran a separate fund at FrontPoint, was slow to respond. "Sorry," the Englishman said wryly. "I just needed to calm down from hearing Steve say the world is ending." And everyone laughed. Later that very day, investors in the collapsed Bear Stearns hedge funds were informed that their $1.6 billion in AAA-rated subprime-backed CDOs had not merely lost some value, they were worthless. Eisman was now convinced a lot of the biggest firms on Wall Street did not understand their own risks and were in peril. At the bottom of his conviction lay his memory of his dinner with Wing Chow when he grasped the central role of the mezzanine CDO and made a massive bet against those very same CDOs. This, of course, raised the question, what exactly is inside a CDO? "I didn't know what the fuck was in the things," said Eisman. "You couldn't do the analysis. You couldn't say, 'Give me all the ones with all California in them.' No one knew what was in them." They learned enough to know, as Danny put it, that it was just all the pieces of shit we'd already shorted wrapped up together into a portfolio. Beyond that, they were flying blind. "Steve's nature is to put it on and figure it out later," said Vinny. Then came news. Eisman had long subscribed to a newsletter, famous in Wall Street circles and obscure outside them, Grant's Interest Rate Observer. Its editor, Jim Grant, had been prophesying doom ever since the great debt cycle began in the mid-1980s. In late 2006, Grant decided to investigate these strange Wall Street creations known as CDOs. Or rather, he had asked his young assistant, Dan Gertner, a chemical engineer with an MBA, to see if he could understand them. Gertner went off with the documents, explaining CDOs to potential investors, and sweated and groaned and heaved and suffered. Then he came back, says Grant, and said, "I can't figure this thing out." And I said, "I think we have our story." Gertner dug and dug and finally concluded that no matter how much digging he did, he'd never be able to get to the bottom of what exactly was inside a CDO, which to Jim Grant meant that no investor possibly could either. In turn, this suggested what Grant already knew, that far too many people were taking far too many financial statements on faith. In early 2007, Grant wrote a series of pieces suggesting that the rating agencies had abandoned their posts, that they were almost surely rating these CDOs without themselves knowing exactly what was inside them. The readers of Grant's have seen for themselves how a stack of non-investment-grade mortgage slices can be rearranged to form a collateral debt obligation, one piece began, and they have stared in amazement at the improvements that this mysterious process can effect in the credit ratings of the slices. For his troubles, Grant, along with his trusted assistant, was called into S&P for a dressing down. "We were actually summoned to the rating agency and told, 'You guys just don't get it,'" says Gertner. Jim used the term alchemy, and they didn't like that term. Just a few miles north of Grant's Wall Street offices, an equity hedge fund manager with a darkening view of the world was wondering why he hadn't heard others voice suspicion about the bond market and its abstruse creations. In Jim Grant's essay, Steve Eisman found independent confirmation of his theory of the financial world. "When I read it," said Eisman, "I thought, 'Oh my God, this is like owning a gold mine.' When I read that, I was the only guy in the equity world who almost had an orgasm." Chapter 8. The Long Quiet. The day Steve Eisman became the first man ever to take almost sexual pleasure in an essay in Grant's Interest Rate Observer, Dr. Michael Berry received from his CFO a copy of the same story, along with a jokey note. "Mike, you haven't taken a side job writing for Grant's, have you?" "I haven't," Barry replied, seeing no obvious good news in the discovery that there was someone out there who thought as he did. "I'm a bit surprised we haven't been contacted by Grant's." He was still in the financial world, but apart from it, as if on the other side of a pane of glass he couldn't bring himself to tap upon. He'd been the first investor to diagnose the disorder in the American financial system in early 2003, the extension of credit by instrument. Complicated financial stuff was being dreamed up for the sole purpose of lending money to people who could never repay it. "I really do believe the final act in play is a crisis in our financial institutions, which are doing such dumb, dumb things," he wrote in April 2003 to a friend who had wondered why Scion Capital's quarterly letters to its investors had turned so dark. "I have a job to do," he continued, "make money for my clients, period. But boy, it gets morbid when you start making investments that work out extra great if a tragedy occurs." Then, in the spring of 2005, he had identified before any other investor precisely which tragedy was most likely to occur when he made a large, explicit bet against subprime mortgage bonds. Now, in February 2007, subprime loans were defaulting in record numbers, financial institutions were less steady every day, and no one but him seemed to recall what he'd said and done. He had told his investors that they might need to be patient, that the bet might not pay off until the mortgages issued in 2005 reached the end of their teaser rate period. They had not been patient. Many of his investors mistrusted him, and he in turn felt betrayed by them. At the beginning, he had imagined the end, but none of the parts in between. "I guess I wanted to just go to sleep and wake up in 2007, he said. To keep his bets against subprime mortgage bonds, he'd been forced to fire half his small staff and dump billions of dollars worth of bets he had made against the companies most closely associated with the subprime mortgage market. He was now more isolated than he'd ever been. The only thing that had changed was his explanation for it. Not long before, his wife had dragged him to the office of a Stanford psychologist. A preschool teacher had noted certain worrying behaviors in their 4-year-old son, Nicholas, and suggested he needed testing. Nicholas didn't sleep when the other kids slept. He drifted off when the teacher talked at any length. His mind seemed very active. Michael Berry had to resist his urge to take offense. He was, after all, a doctor, and he suspected that the teacher was trying to tell him that he had failed to diagnose attention deficit disorder in his own son. I had worked in an ADHD clinic during my residency and had strong feelings that this was overdiagnosed, he said. That it was a savior diagnosis for too many kids whose parents wanted a medical reason to drug their children or to explain their kids' bad behavior. He suspected his son was a bit different from the other kids, but different in a good way. He asked a ton of questions, said Berry. I had encouraged that because I always had a ton of questions as a kid, and I was frustrated when I was told to be quiet. Now he watched his son more carefully and noted that the little boy, while smart, had problems with other people. When he did try to interact, even though he didn't do anything mean to the other kids, he'd somehow tick them off. He came home and told his wife, "Don't worry about it. He's fine." His wife stared at him and asked, "How would you know?" To which Dr. Michael Berry replied, "Because he's just like me. That's how I was." Their son's application to several kindergartens met with quick rejections, unaccompanied by explanations. Pressed, one of the schools told Berry that his son suffered from inadequate gross and fine motor skills. He had apparently scored very low on tests involving art and scissor use, said Berry. Big deal, I thought. I still draw like a 4-year-old, and I hate art. To silence his wife, however, he agreed to have their son tested. It would just prove he's a smart kid, an absent-minded genius. Instead, the tests administered by a child psychologist proved that their child had Asperger's syndrome. A classic case, she said, and recommended that the child be pulled from the mainstream and sent to a special school. And Dr. Michael Berry was dumbstruck. He recalled Asperger's from med school, but vaguely. His wife now handed him the stack of books she had accumulated on autism and related disorders. On top were The Complete Guide to Asperger's Syndrome by a clinical psychologist named Tony Atwood and Atwood's Asperger's Syndrome, A Guide for Parents and Professionals. Marked impairment in the use of multiple nonverbal behaviors such as eye-to-eye gaze. Check. Failure to develop peer relationships. Check. A lack of spontaneous seeking to share enjoyment, interests, or achievements with other people. Check. Difficulty reading the social-emotional messages in someone's eyes. Check. A faulty emotion regulation or control mechanism for expressing anger. Check. One of the reasons why computers are so appealing is not only that you do not have to talk or socialize with them, but that they are logical, consistent, and not prone to moods. Thus, they are an ideal interest for the person with Asperger's syndrome. Check. Many people have a hobby. The difference between the normal range and the eccentricity observed in Asperger's syndrome is that these pursuits are often solitary, idiosyncratic, and dominate the person's time and conversation. Check, check, check. After a few pages, Michael Berry realized that he was no longer reading about his son, but about himself. How many people can pick up a book and find an instruction manual for their life, he said. I hated reading a book telling me who I was. I thought I was different, but this was saying I was the same as other people. My wife and I were a typical Asperger's couple, and we had an Asperger's son. His glass eye no longer explained anything. The wonder is that it ever had. How did a glass eye explain, in a competitive swimmer, a pathological fear of deep water? The terror of not knowing what lurked beneath him. How did it explain a childhood passion for washing money? He'd take dollar bills and wash them, dry them off with a towel, press them between the pages of books, and then stack books on top of those books, all so he might have money that looked new. All of a sudden I've become this caricature, said Berry. I've always been able to study up on something and ace something really fast. I thought it was all something special about me. Now it's like, oh, a lot of Asperger's people can do that. Now I was explained by a disorder. He resisted the news. He had a gift for finding and analyzing information on the subjects that interested him intensely. He had always been intensely interested in himself. Now, at the age of 35, he'd been handed this new piece of information about himself, and his first reaction to it was to wish he hadn't been given it. "My first thought was that a lot of people must have this and don't know it," he said, "and I wondered, is this really a good thing for me to know at this point? Why is it good for me to know this about myself?" He went and found his own psychologist to help him sort out the effect of his syndrome on his wife and children. His work life, however, remained uninformed by the new information. He didn't alter the way he made investment decisions, for instance, or the way he communicated with his investors. He didn't let his investors know of his disorder. "I didn't feel it was a material fact that had to be disclosed," he said. "It wasn't a change. I wasn't diagnosed with something new. It's something I'd always had." On the other hand, it explained an awful lot about what he did for a living and how he did it. His obsessive acquisition of hard facts, his insistence on logic, his ability to plow quickly through reams of tedious financial statements. People with Asperger's couldn't control what they were interested in. It was a stroke of luck that his special interest was financial markets and not, say, collecting lawnmower catalogs. When he thought of it in that way, he realized that complex modern financial markets were as good as designed to reward a person with Asperger's who took an interest in them. "Only someone who has Asperger's would read a subprime mortgage bond prospectus," he said. By early 2007, Michael Berry found himself in a characteristically bizarre situation. He'd bought insurance on a lot of truly crappy subprime mortgage bonds created from loans made in 2005, but they were his credit default swaps. They weren't traded often by others. A lot of people took the view that the loans made in 2005 were somehow sounder than the loans made in 2006. In bond market parlance, they were off the run. That was their biggest claim. The pools of loans he had bet against were, quote, relatively clean. To counter the assertion, he commissioned a private study and found that the pools of loans he had shorted were nearly twice as likely to be in bankruptcy and a third more likely to have been foreclosed upon than the general run of 2005 subprime deals. The loans made in 2006 were indeed worse than those made in 2005, but the loans made in 2005 remained atrocious and closer to the dates when their interest rates would reset. He had picked exactly the right homeowners to bet against. All through 2006 and the first few months of 2007, Berry sent his list of credit default swaps to Goldman and Bank of America and Morgan Stanley with the idea they would show it to possible buyers, so he might get some idea of the market price. That, after all, was the dealer's stated function, middlemen, market makers. That is not the function they served, however. It seemed the dealers were just sitting on my lists and bidding extremely opportunistically themselves, said Berry. The data from the mortgage servicers was worse every month. The loans underlying the bonds were going bad at faster rates, and yet the price of insuring those loans, they said, was falling. Logic had failed me, he said. I couldn't explain the outcomes I was seeing. At the end of each day, there was meant to be a tiny reckoning. If the subprime market had fallen, they would wire money to him. If it had strengthened, he would wire money to them. The fate of Scion Capital turned on these bets, but that fate was not, in the short run, determined by an open and free market. It was determined by Goldman Sachs and Bank of America and Morgan Stanley, who decided each day whether Mike Berry's credit default swaps had made or lost money. It was true, however, that his portfolio of credit default swaps was uncommon. They were selected by an uncommon character, with an uncommon view of the financial markets, operating alone and apart. This fact alone enabled Wall Street firms to dictate to him the market price. With no one else buying and selling exactly what Michael Berry was buying and selling, there was no hard evidence what these things were worth, so they were worth whatever Goldman Sachs and Morgan Stanley said they were worth. Berry detected a pattern in how they managed their market. All good news about the housing market or the economy was treated as an excuse to demand collateral from Scion Capital. All bad news was poo-pooed as in some way irrelevant to the specific bets he had made. The firms always claimed that they had no position themselves, that they were running matched books, but their behavior told him otherwise. Whatever the bank's net position was would determine the mark, he said. I don't think they were looking to the market for their marks. I think they were looking to their needs. That is, the reason they refused to acknowledge that his bet was paying off was that they were on the other side of it. When you talk to dealers, he wrote in March 2006 to his in-house lawyer, Steve Druskin, you are getting the view from their book. Whatever they've got on their book will be their view. Goldman happens to be warehousing a lot of this risk. They'll talk as if nothing has been seen in the mortgage pools. No need to incite panic. And this has worked. As long as they can entice more money into the market, the problem is resolved. That's been the history of the last 3 to 4 years. By April 2006, he'd finished buying insurance on subprime mortgage bonds. In a portfolio of $555 million, he had laid $1.9 billion of these peculiar bets, bets that should be paying off, but were not. In May, he adopted a new tactic, asking Wall Street traders if they would be willing to sell him even more credit default swaps at the price they claimed they were worth, knowing that they were not. Never once has any counterparty been willing to sell me my list at my marks, he wrote in an email. 80 to 90% of the names on my list are not even available at any price. A properly functioning market would assimilate new information into the prices of securities. This multi-trillion-dollar market in subprime mortgage risk never budged. One of the oldest adages in investing is that if you're reading about it in the paper, it's too late, he said. Not this time. Steve Druskin was becoming more involved in the market and couldn't believe how controlled it was. What's amazing is that they make a market in this fantasy stuff, said Druskin. It's not a real asset. It was as if Wall Street had decided to allow everyone to gamble on the punctuality of commercial airlines. The likelihood of United Flight 001 arriving on time obviously shifted with the weather, mechanical issues, pilot quality, and so on. But shifting probabilities could be ignored until the plane did or did not arrive. It didn't matter when big mortgage lenders like Onit or ResCap failed, or some pool of subprime loans experienced higher-than-expected losses. All that mattered was what Goldman Sachs and Morgan Stanley decided should matter. The world's single biggest capital market wasn't a market. It was something else. But what? I am actually protesting to my counterparties that there must be fraud in the marketplace for credit default swaps to be at all-time lows, Barry wrote in an email to an investor he trusted. What if CDSs are a fraud? I'm asking myself that question all the time, and never have I felt that I should be thinking that way more than now. No way we should be down 5% this year just in mortgage CDSs. To his Goldman Sachs saleswoman, he wrote, I think I'm short housing, but I am not, because CDSs are criminal. When, a few months later, Goldman Sachs announced it was setting aside $542,000 per employee for the 2006 bonus pool, he wrote again, As a former gas station attendant, parking lot attendant, medical resident, and current Goldman Sachs screwee, I am offended. In the middle of 2006, he began to hear of other money managers who wanted to make the same bet he did. A few actually called and asked for his help. I had all these people telling me I needed to get out of this trade, he said, and I was looking at these other people and thinking how lucky they were to be able to get into this trade. If the market had been at all rational, it would have blown up long before. Some of the biggest funds on the planet have picked my brain and copied my strategy, he wrote in an email, so it won't just be Scion that makes money if this happens. Still, it won't be everyone. He was now undeniably miserable. It feels like my insides are digesting themselves, he wrote to his wife in mid-September. The source of his unhappiness was, as usual, other people. The other people who bothered him the most were his own investors. When he opened his fund in 2000, he released only his quarterly returns and told his investors that he planned to tell them next to nothing about what he was up to. Now they were demanding monthly and even fortnightly reports, and pestered him constantly about the wisdom of his pessimism. I almost think the better the idea, and the more iconoclastic the investor, the more likely you will get screamed at by investors, he said. He didn't worry about how screwed up the market for some security became, because he knew that eventually it would be disciplined by logic. Businesses either thrived or failed. Loans either were paid off or were defaulted upon. But these people whose money he ran were incapable of keeping their emotional distance from the market. They were now responding to the same surface stimuli as the entire screwed-up subprime mortgage market, and trying to force him to conform to its madness. "I do my best to have patience," he wrote to one investor, "but I can only be as patient as my investors." To another griping investor, he wrote, "The definition of an intelligent manager in the hedge fund world is someone who has the right idea and sees his investors abandon him just before the idea pays off." When he was making them huge sums of money, he had barely heard from them. The moment he started actually to lose a little, they peppered him with their doubts and suspicions. "So I take it the monster dragging us out to sea is the CDS. You have created the plight of the old man in the sea. When do you see the end of the bleeding? August down again 5%. Are you running a riskier strategy now? You make me physically ill. How dare you? Can you explain to me how we keep losing money on this position? If our potential losses are fixed, it would seem to me, based on how much we have lost, that they should be a tiny part of the portfolio now." This last question kept popping up. How could a stock picker be losing so much on this one quixotic bond market bet? And he kept trying to answer it. He was committed to paying annual premiums amounting to about 8% of the portfolio every year for as long as the underlying loans existed, likely around 5 years, but possibly as long as 30. 8% times 5 years came to 40%. If the value of the credit default swaps fell by half, Scion registered a mark-to-market loss of 20%. More alarmingly, his credit default swap contracts contained a provision that allowed the big Wall Street firms to cancel their bets with Scion if Scion's assets fell below a certain level. There was suddenly a real risk that that might happen. Most of his investors had agreed to a 2-year lockup and could not pull their money out at will. But of the $555 million he had under management, $302 million was eligible to be withdrawn either at the end of 2006 or in the middle of 2007, and investors were lining up to ask for their money back. In October 2006, with U.S. house prices experiencing their greatest decline in 35 years, and just weeks before the ABX index of BBB mortgage bonds experienced its first credit event, that is, loss, Michael Berry faced the likelihood of a run on his fund, a fund that was now devoted to betting against the subprime mortgage market. "We were clinically depressed," said one of the several analysts Berry employed but never figured out what to do with, as he insisted on doing all the analysis himself. "You'd go to work and you'd say, 'I don't want to be here.' The trade was moving against you, and investors wanted out." One night, as Berry was complaining to his wife about the complete absence of long-term perspective in the financial markets, a thought struck him. His agreement with his investors gave him the right to keep their money if he had invested it in securities for which there is no public market or that are not freely tradable. It was left to the manager to decide if there was a public market for a security. If Michael Berry thought there wasn't, for instance, if he thought a market was temporarily not functioning or somehow fraudulent, he was permitted to side-pocket an investment. That is, he could tell his investors that they couldn't have their money back until the bet he'd made with it had run its natural course. And so he did what seemed to him the only proper and logical thing to do. He side-pocketed his credit default swaps. The long list of investors eager to get their money back from him, a list that included his founding backer, Gotham Capital, received the news from him in a terse letter. He was locking up between 50% and 55% of their money. Berry followed this letter with his quarterly report, which he hoped might make everyone feel a bit better. But he had no talent for caring what others thought of him. It was almost as if he didn't know how to do it. What he wrote sounded less like an apology than an assault. Never before have I been so optimistic about the portfolio for a reason that has nothing to do with stocks, it began. And then it went on to explain how he had established a position in the markets that should be the envy of any money manager. How he had placed a bet not on housing Armageddon, even though he suspected that was coming, but on the worst 5% or so of loans made in 2005. How his investors should feel lucky. He wrote as if he was sitting on top of the world, when he was expected to feel as if the world was sitting on top of him. One of his biggest New York investors shot him an email. I'd be careful in the future using derogatory phrases such as, "We're short the mortgage portfolio everyone would want if they knew what they were doing," and "Sooner or later one of the big boys should really read a prospectus." One of his original two email friends, both had stuck by him, wrote, "Nobody else except the North Korean dictator, Kim Jong-il, would write a letter like that when they were down 17%. Immediately, his partners at Gotham Capital threatened to sue him. They soon were joined by others, who began to organize themselves into a legal fighting force. What distinguished Gotham was that their leaders flew out from New York to San Jose and tried to bully Barry into giving them back the $100 million they had invested with him. In January 2006, Gotham's creator, Joel Greenblatt, had gone on television to promote a book, and when asked to name his favorite value investors, had extolled the virtues of a rare talent named Mike Barry. 10 months later, he traveled 3,000 miles with his partner, John Petrie, to tell Mike Barry he was a liar and to pressure him into abandoning the bet Barry viewed as the single shrewdest of his career. "If there was one moment I might have caved, that was it," said Barry. "Joel was like a godfather to me, a partner in my firm, the guy that discovered me and backed me before anyone outside my family did. I respected him and looked up to him." Now, as Greenblatt told him, no judge in any court of law would side with his decision to side-pocket what was clearly a tradable security, whatever feelings Mike Barry had for him vanished. When Greenblatt asked to see a list of the subprime mortgage bonds Barry had bet against, Barry refused. From Greenblatt's point of view, he had given this guy $100 million, and the guy was not only refusing to give it back, but to even talk to him. And Greenblatt had a point. It was wildly unconventional to side-pocket an investment for which there was obviously a market. There was clearly some low price at which Michael Barry might bail out of his bet against the subprime mortgage bond market. To some meaningful number of his investors, it looked as if Barry simply did not want to accept the judgment of the marketplace. He'd made a bad bet and was failing to accept his loss. But to Barry, the judgment of the marketplace was fraudulent, and Joel Greenblatt didn't know what he was talking about. "It became clear to me that they still didn't understand the credit default swap positions," he said. He was acutely aware that a great many of the people who had given him their money now despised him. The awareness caused him to, A, withdraw into his office and shout "fuck" at the top of his lungs even more than usual, B, develop a new contempt for his own investors, and C, keep trying to explain his actions to them, even though they quite clearly were no longer listening. "I would prefer that you talk less and listen more," his lawyer, Steve Druskin, wrote to him in late October 2006. "They are strategizing litigation." It was kind of interesting, said Kip Oberting, who had arranged for White Mountains to become Barry's other original investor before leaving for other ventures, because he had explained exactly what he was doing, and he had made people a bunch of money. You would have thought people would stick with him. They weren't merely not sticking with him, but fleeing as fast as he would allow them. They hated him. "I just don't understand why people just don't see that I don't mean any harm," he said. Late on the night of December 29th, Michael Barry sat alone in his office and typed a quick email to his wife. "So incredibly depressing. I'm trying to come home, but I'm just so mad and depressed right now." And so in January 2007, just before Steve Eisman and Charlie Ledley headed gleefully to Las Vegas, Michael Barry sat down to explain to his investors how, in a year when the S&P had risen by more than 10%, he had lost 18.4%. A person who had money with him from the beginning would have enjoyed gains of 186% over those 6 years, compared to 10.13% for the S&P 500 index. But Berry's long-term success was no longer relevant. He was now being judged monthly. The year just completed was one in which I underperformed nearly all my peers and friends by, variably, 30 or 40 percentage points, he wrote. A money manager does not go from being a near nobody to being nearly universally applauded to being nearly universally vilified without some effect. The effect, he went on to demonstrate, was to make him ever more certain that the entire financial world was wrong and he was right. I have always believed that a single talented analyst, working very hard, can cover an amazing amount of investment landscape, and this belief remains unchallenged in my mind, he wrote. Then he returned, as he always did, to the not-so-small matter of his credit default swaps. All the important facts pointed to their eventual success. In just the last 2 months, three big mortgage originators had failed. The Center for Responsible Lending was now predicting that in 2007, 2.2 million borrowers would lose their homes, and one in five subprime mortgages issued in 2005 and 2006 would fail. Michael Berry was as good as teed up to become a Wall Street villain. His quarterly letters to his investors, which Berry considered private, were now routinely leaked to the press. A nasty piece appeared in a trade journal suggesting that he had behaved unethically in side-pocketing his bet, and Berry felt certain it had been planted by one of his own investors. "Mike wasn't paranoid," said a New York investor who observed the behavior of other New York investors in Scion Capital. "People really were out to get him. When he becomes a bad guy, he becomes this greedy sociopath who is going to steal all the money. And he can always go back to being a neurologist. It was the first thing everyone jumped to with Mike. He was a doctor." Berry began to hear strange rumors about himself. He'd left his wife and gone into hiding. He had fled to South America. "It's an interesting life I'm leading lately," Berry wrote to one of his email friends. "With all that has gone on recently, I've had the opportunity to talk with many of our investors, which is the first time I've done so in the history of the funds. I've been shocked by what I've heard. It appears that investors only have passingly paid attention to my letters, and many have been clinging to various rumors and hearsay in place of analysis or original thought. I've variably launched a private equity fund, tried to buy a Venezuelan gold company, launched a separate hedge fund called Milton's Opus, got divorced, got blown up, never disclosed the derivatives trade, borrowed $8 billion, spent much of the last 2 years in Asia, accused everyone but me on Wall Street of being idiots, siphoned off the capital of the funds into my personal account, and more or less turned Scion into the next Amaranth, a Connecticut-based hedge fund that lost $6.8 billion in bets on natural gas in early 2006 and blew up in spectacular fashion. "None of this," Berry added, "is made up." He'd always been different from what one might expect a hedge fund manager to be. He wore the same shorts and T-shirts to work for days on end. He refused to wear shoes with laces. He refused to wear watches or even his wedding ring. To calm himself at work, he often blared heavy metal music. "I think these personal foibles of mine were tolerated among many as long as things were going well," he said. "But when things weren't going well, they became signs of incompetence or instability on my part, even among employees and business partners." After the conference in Las Vegas, the market had dropped, then recovered right through until the end of May. To Charlie Ledley at Cornwall Capital, the U.S. financial system appeared systematically corrupted by a cabal of Wall Street banks, rating agencies, and government regulators. To Steve Eisman at Front Point Partners, the market seemed mainly stupid or delusional, a financial culture that had experienced so many tiny panics, followed by robust booms, saw any sell-off as merely another buying opportunity. To Michael Berry, the subprime mortgage market looked increasingly like a fraud perpetrated by a handful of subprime bond trading desks. "Given the massive cheating on the part of our counterparties, the idea of taking the CDSs out of the side pocket is no longer worth considering," he wrote at the end of March 2007. The first half of 2007 was a very strange period in financial history. The facts on the ground in the housing market diverged further and further from the prices on the bonds and the insurance on the bonds. Faced with unpleasant facts, the big Wall Street firms appeared to be choosing simply to ignore them. There were subtle changes in the market, however, and they turned up in Barry's email box. On March 19th, his salesman at Citigroup sent him, for the first time, serious analysis on a pool of mortgages. The mortgages were not subprime, but Alt-A. Still, the guy was trying to explain how much of the pool consisted of interest-only loans, what percentage was owner-occupied, and so on. The way a person might do who actually was thinking about the creditworthiness of the borrowers. When I was analyzing these back in 2005, Barry wrote in an email, sounding like Stanley watching tourists march through the jungle on a path he had himself hacked, there was nothing even remotely close to this sort of analysis coming out of brokerage houses. I glommed onto silent seconds as an indicator of a stretched buyer and made it a high-value criterion in my selection process. But at the time, no one trading derivatives had any idea what I was talking about, and no one thought they mattered. In the long quiet between February and June 2007, they had begun to matter. The market was on edge. In the first quarter of 2007, Scion Capital was up nearly 18%. Then something changed, though at first it was hard to see what it was. On June 14th, the pair of subprime mortgage bond hedge funds, effectively owned by Bear Stearns, went belly up. In the ensuing 2 weeks, the publicly traded index of BBB-rated subprime mortgage bonds fell by nearly 20%. Just then, Goldman Sachs appeared to Barry to be experiencing a nervous breakdown. His biggest positions were with Goldman, and Goldman was newly unable or unwilling to determine the value of those positions, and so could not say how much collateral should be shifted back and forth. On Friday, June 15th, Barry's Goldman Sachs saleswoman, Veronica Grinstein, vanished. He called and emailed her, but she didn't respond until late the following Monday to tell him that she was out for the day. "This is a recurrent theme whenever the market moves our way," wrote Barry. "People get sick. People are off for unspecified reasons." On June 20th, Grinstein finally returned to tell him that Goldman Sachs had experienced systems failure. "That was funny," Barry replied, "because Morgan Stanley had said more or less the same thing. And his salesman at Bank of America claimed they'd had a power outage. I viewed these system problems as excuses for buying time to sort out a mess behind the scenes," he said. The Goldman saleswoman made a weak effort to claim that, even as the index of subprime mortgage bonds collapsed, the market for insuring them hadn't budged. But she did it from her cell phone, rather than the office line, on which the conversations would have been recorded. They were caving, all of them. At the end of every month, for nearly 2 years, Barry had watched Wall Street traders mark his positions against him. That is, at the end of every month, his bets against subprime bonds were mysteriously less valuable. The end of every month also happened to be when Wall Street traders sent their profit and loss statements to their managers and risk managers. On June 29th, Barry received a note from his Morgan Stanley salesman, Art Ringness, saying that Morgan Stanley now wanted to make sure that, quote, "the marks are fair." The next day, Goldman followed suit. It was the first time in 2 years that Goldman Sachs had not moved the trade against him at the end of the month. "That was the first time they moved our marks accurately," Barry notes, "because they were getting in on the trade themselves." The market was finally accepting the diagnosis of its own disorder. The moment Goldman was getting in on his trade was also the moment the market flipped. Some kind of rout was on now. Everyone at once seemed eager to talk to him, Morgan Stanley, which had been by far the most reluctant to acknowledge negative news in subprime, now called to say it would like to buy whatever he had in any size. Barry heard a rumor, soon confirmed, that a fund run by Goldman called Global Alpha had taken huge losses in subprime, and that Goldman itself had rapidly turned from betting on the subprime mortgage market to betting against it. It was precisely the moment he had told his investors, back in the summer of 2005, that they only needed to wait for. Crappy mortgages worth three-quarters of a trillion dollars were resetting from their teaser rates to new, higher ones. A single pool of mortgages, against which Barry had laid a bet, illustrated the general point. OOMLT 2005-3. OOMLT 2005-3 was shorthand for a pool of subprime mortgage loans made by Option One, the company whose CEO